I'm Wayne Tilsley, Anglican minister at Richmond in Sydney. I grew up in a family where I was made to go to church as a child. My mother was religious. It's hard to know whether she had faith, but she had some sort of faith. But she was really keen on us going to Sunday school, us going to our youth group. I went along, but when I could get out of youth group, I did, and I didn't have any more to do with church. And I thought, yeah, I'm getting too old for this, I don't need it. Then I went into the police cadets, talking to Des about that. We're both in the cadets. He was a bit earlier than I was. But I went into the police cadets for a couple of years, because one of my friends from school did, and I was I wasn't sure about what I was going to do, and I was interested when he went to cadets, so I went on to check it out. And when I went to check it out, next minute they've got me measured up and signed up before I know it. Anyway, and it was the best thing for me. It was really good. I became a policeman, and I was suddenly faced with the side of the world that you don't normally see. And I was at Liverpool, and Liverpool in those days, in 73, there was a lot going on in Liverpool. It was a challenging place to be. And as a young policeman, I was in there about 12 months, seeing all this stuff, and I ended up was starting to ask a lot of questions about, you know, what's life all about, and how come I'm seeing so much death, and I'm seeing some horrible things happen to people that shouldn't happen, I came from a butchering family. My grandfather butchered shop. I grew up in the butcher shop. I would have been a butcher, except I copped all the rotten jobs, you know, out the back, washing this and doing that, and decided I didn't want to do that. But I was pretty well qualified as a butcher by the time I was about 15. And I knew a lot about animals, and sorry if you've got a weak stomach, but I end up as a policeman having to go a lot of post-mortems, and I end up copying the post-mortems on the weekends, which was a challenge because there was no wardsman there, and the doctor would say, here, you've got to tuck the gown, the gloves, you've got to help me. And the only way I'd get through a post-mortem then was to make an anatomy lesson out of it with the doctor. And that was quite interesting, got my mind off what was going on. But as I'm making an anatomy lesson out of it with the doctor, and they quite love doing that, I couldn't help but think, you know, gee, what's the difference between this human body and the animals in my father's butcher shop? You know, there's different parts, but they're all there, and I've seen them before, and I've cut them up before. And then I start thinking, in the end, the thing that makes a human being different is that part inside, our thoughts, our personality, the being that's, you know, beyond the physical body, but who we are. And I'm thinking, that's what makes those animals in the butcher shop different from this person here. But it's now gone. And I'm asking all these questions, I'm thinking about it as God would have it. I'm with some school friends and I join a basketball team they've got going, and we go over to a neighbouring town. I'm from Cairns, and we go across to Picton and we're playing basketball. And we were all playing outdoor courts, and there was a number of teams at the same time, and we would rotate around playing one team each week and play different teams. I got to notice a team, and when we played them and I saw them playing each week too, they were different from all the others because they really got on well together, and someone messed up a shot, someone did the wrong thing, they didn't jump on them and yell at them and go on, they actually encouraged them. I thought, gee, they're a friendly group. After a while I started thinking, maybe they've been drinking, maybe they just relaxed and been drinking. Yeah? Or then I thought, maybe they're on drugs, maybe they're smoking marijuana or something, and they're just too easy going. And got to know them. They were a Christian group, for a youth group from a church in Picton. I thought, okay. And then they started talking about Jesus, and I'm thinking, oh, yeah, dead and gone. And they're talking about Jesus like he's their friend and alive. And I was thinking, what's going on here? So I started going along with them to their youth group things, and I started to get interested in Jesus. And I thought, gee, as a policeman, I'd really like to look at the evidence. I need to get a Bible. I don't want to go and buy a Bible. Bam. The Gideons gave me a Bible back in the beginning of high school. Where did I put that? I went home to my bookshelf, and it was under all this dust. Took a bit of time to find this little pocket testament, and I pulled it out and dusted it off, and I started reading it. And for Gideons, this is my Gideon testament. But I started reading it, and I would have been just too shy and embarrassed to go and get one or ask one, but because I had it there, it was accessible. And so I started reading. I started reading through the Gospels, and as I read through the Gospels, I put my police mind to it, saying, I'm going to look for witnesses, I'm going to look for evidence, I'm going to look to see it's true, it can't be true, I'll easily spot the things that are wrong. And I couldn't. In fact, I found things that didn't agree. I thought, they haven't worked out their story on this one. But then I put them together and saw they complemented each other. It was like when I went to an incident and people would sort of say different things from different perspectives where they were, but when it all came together, it made sense. And I saw that with the Gospels. And then I saw the resurrection of Jesus in the Gospel. I thought, this has got to be a long one. Can't believe this one. And then I started seeing the evidence for the resurrection. I thought, this is true. I don't see it today, but it did happen with Jesus. And in the end, when I got to Paul, that really convinced me. When I saw that an enemy of Christ would see Christ and change like he did, that was the final straw. That was it. I said, yes, it's true. Jesus is Saviour, Lord, and responded to him. I was at a church service and the minister, a good friend of Steve and I, Barry Schofield, was preaching. And I don't know what he was preaching about, but I do remember at one point in the sermon he was talking about Revelation chapter 3 verse 20, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." And he made the point that it's like a door where there's no handle on the outside. It's on the inside and you have to open up. I, as a policeman, knew that because I went to so many front doors and they just didn't open up and go in. They were locked on the inside. I had to knock on the door and people would let me in. I just knew that all the time. And so when he said that, it just rang true to me. Yes, I have to open up my life and let Jesus come in. He's not going to, you know, kick the door in like I would sometimes do anyway as a policeman. But it wasn't good for relationships when you kick the door in. You're arresting someone rather than being a friend. Anyway, so I responded and my life just was transformed from that moment. I remember going home and just sort of, just on this sort of strange feeling of freedom and release. And as a policeman, I'd been under a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, a lot of trouble. And two things happened that night. I didn't realise actually for 3 weeks. I had this sort of, you know, something had happened. I was really free and released and enjoying life the way I'd never enjoyed it before. And then 3 weeks later, I realised that I'd been smoking, and I'd picked up smoking when I was in the cadets because other guys were smoking, and it was a really bad thing to do because I remember chasing someone at Green Valley one night when I was at Liverpool over fences and through yards, and in the end, I just collapsed on the ground. I thought I was going to die. I couldn't breathe. And I really then decided I had to give up smoking. And I'd been trying, and I couldn't. I kept breaking it, and I'd been trying for ages and not working. And 3 weeks after I responded to Christ, I realised I hadn't smoked. I had no desire for smoking. It just left me. There was no effort. Just gone. And I'd been relying on alcohol as a crutch as a policeman. You know, you get in a culture of drinking a bit. And I've been relying on that after work, particularly to cope with things. And then I suddenly realised I hadn't had a drink of alcohol nor a desire for alcohol for that 3 weeks. And I thought, wow, you know, something really has happened to me. I then had a challenge of how then do I be a policeman and, you know, be a Christian. And I'd like to read to you something here from 2 Corinthians chapter 12. Because Paul's writing here, Paul's a great man of God. And he says about a thorn in the flesh, but he says about how God is able to work through him. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 verse 12, he's received these revelations. He says, "Because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, for this reason, to keep me from exalting myself, there was given to me a thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from exalting myself." Now, some people think nowadays that might have been epilepsy. We're not really sure what that was, but it was a problem for him. It was a severe problem. It really threw a spanner in his works. It really made life hard for him. And he prayed and prayed and prayed, but it wouldn't go away. "Concerning this, I implored the Lord 3 times that it might leave me. And he said to me, 'My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness.'" And when I read that, those words jumped out. My grace is sufficient. It's all we need. It's sufficient. We don't need any more. "For power is made perfect in weakness." And I can identify with weakness. And even this morning, I can identify with being weak. I don't like publicly speaking, but I can just identify that as I stand up here as a follower of Jesus Christ and rely on him, then I can be strong in a way I can't be otherwise. I'll tell you some stories about that later. Goes on, "Most gladly, therefore, I rather boast about my weakness so the power of Christ may dwell in me." So whatever I tell you today about, you know, stories and things that happen, don't think I'm a great person. Don't think Wayne is, you know, got tremendous faith. Wayne is special. I'm not. I'm just like all of you. In fact, I'm worse than all of you. Don't worry about that. But it's the God, it's Jesus Christ that makes the difference in me and in you. Goes on to say, therefore I am well content with weakness, with insults, with distress, with persecutions, with difficulties for Christ's sake. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. When I'm weak, then I'm strong. Paul realizes when he faces trouble, he can be content, well content. What does it mean to be content? It means to be at peace. It means to accept. It means to, you know, get on with things and not, you know, just work through it. And he can do that, whatever's going on, because he knows when he's weak, then he's strong. When he's weak, therefore, he has to rely on Jesus Christ more. And when he does that, things happen. I found that as a policeman, because as I started to work out what does it mean to be a Christian policeman, I thought, well, I've got to do what is right, and I've got to do what is right not by what's publicly seen, but also my motives and what people don't know about. I've got to do what is right. I did start doing things like we'd have meal time at work, and I thought, you know, I really want to read the Bible. How am I going to do that? And finally I got the courage enough to read the Bible while I was having my lunch, but other guys noticed that. And I didn't really want to do that, but I still really wanted to read the Bible. And I started Camden, I was in those days, and when I was at Camden, small station, 9 police officers, and some high patrol or STP in those days. And when I was at Camden, it became obvious I was a Christian, so the guys really tested me out when I was there. I'm trying to work out what it means to be a Christian policeman, and these guys tested me. So they would keep pulling practical jokes on me. In those days we had the old black Baker-like phones, and I would be on the office desk and come in to work, and I'd have to man the desk, and they knew I was going to be there. And as soon as I'd come in, the phone would ring, and I'd pick up the phone, put it in my ear, and then I realised there's boot polish all over the phone. It's on my hand, it's on my ear. You know, they put the boot polish on. Or it was glue. You know, there was glue on the earpiece, and there's glue in my ear. Or one time I went in, I was doing all the station work at one stage, and I went in one night to, at 9 o'clock to start, 9 PM to 5 AM work, and I reached underneath to pull out my tray, and here's this red belly back snake coiled up in the tray, you know? Like really lifelike, it was dead, but I just jumped from the seat to the desk, pulled out my gun and just about to start blasting it. And there's about 5 people, and all they could do, they were busting themselves laughing. One guy was actually rolling on the floor, but 4 of them were standing there laughing, and all they could do was bang on the metal lockers. They couldn't talk. They were just banging on the lockers to get my attention while they're killing themselves laughing, where I'm just about to blast this snake, you know. And they only just got me in time because I was really ready to unload on the snake. I was terrified. And you used to get a lot of call-outs because we were understaffed, and it was quite common that you get called. You know, you might be on day shift, and then you're coming in to work at 9 o'clock. The night shift, you work by yourself in those days, and it's quite common. Say at about 6 o'clock, you might get called in early because there's a shortage, and they'd make someone from the morning work a bit later, and someone in the evening come in. So I'm just about sitting down for tea, and I get a call. I've got to go in early. You know? So eat my tea and get my clothes on, and I'm just about to go out the door and the phone ring. 10 minutes later, they're laughing on the phone. You know, they played a practical joke on me. You know? I went back there later, cut the story change. I went back there later as a minister, the way God worked things. And the guys who were at the station that were still living there, four of them, came up to me and said, Wayne, we just gave you hell. We didn't think Christianity was, you know, real. We want to test you out. And can I tell you, we were impressed. And I thought, well, you guys really did give me hell. When I left, I had the most amazing, you know, police send officer, all different, and a lot of them, they're a big rowdy sort of affair. We had the most amazing send off. They took us to a restaurant with my wife and I, and all it was just a really great night. And I could see there was something different amongst their attitude. And that was what it was, because they really tested me, and they were, yeah, they saw it was fair to come. And I was, oh, thank you, Lord. As a policeman, I often work by myself. When I was at Camden, and when I was at Mossvale and Robertson, and sometimes I work with someone, but often by myself. I seemed to work often by myself when I ran into some big issues, and particularly at Robertson, where Robertson should be a quiet rural area. It was anything but that. When I came to Robertson, there was lots of marijuana being grown by people down Wollongong. There was lots of stolen cars being stripped and dumped. There was murders and rapes being committed in the bush. There was groups of people who were coming in. We had a lot of Pitt Street farmer type people who would buy properties and develop them, put in really lavish furnishings, all this new farming equipment and stuff. And then people would come along with removals, vans and trucks and stuff and clean them out. That was going on a lot. Then we had the Illawarra Highway going through, so we had some pretty interesting people travelling down there. And I suddenly found that praying to God and talking to local people and getting them supporting me and helping me, I worked out later on I had 30 pairs of eyes across the area reporting back to me anything going on that shouldn't be happening, like, you know, ringing me up. And I said to them, you know, if you see something, if you can get the description of a car and number plate, but don't try, and if you see which way the car goes, and I don't mind coming out if it's a false alarm, just give me a call, and I always report back to the result and stuff. And I got an enormous amount of stuff. And I'd be patrolling around too, and God would provide things for me. And I even found, in my time there, I found that some of the marijuana growers would be growing their marijuana, you know, kilometres in the bush. And I worked with a waterboard guy, and he taught me to track, and we were pretty good. He taught me to see the difference between animals like kangaroo and wombat tracks. He taught me to see that this thing's broken and someone's been through here in the last 24 hours or a couple of days ago. We could track pretty well. So we'd see a car or something parked and I'd call him up and there'd be a fire trail. He'd walk one side, I'd walk the other, and we'd go and look for tracks. And sooner or later we'd cut a track. We'd say, over here. And we'd follow in and get them. And sometimes we'd find cars and I was by myself and I couldn't bring my mate over, and I'd get people in the car, so they're already there. I don't know where they are. And I found that God could make people tell the truth. And it all happened one night about 1 a.m. winter's night, Jamboree Road, a popular spot where they come and do insurance jobs on cars, where they come and torture cars for the insurance money. And I got out there, and here's one car, just had the driver's seat in it, completely gutted inside, dash everything gone, just the driver's seat, drum of petrol, rags, matches, and, you know, this guy, I thought, this guy's going to burn this car. And behind there's another car, fully intact, with another guy in it. And I got split them apart, and the guy in the front says, oh, I've just re-dumped the car, I'm just taking it for a test drive, and this is petrol in case I run out and all this. And quite a viable story that you really at court wouldn't have been able to prove otherwise. And then the guy, and I said, who's this bloke? Oh, he's my mate, he's following me. Oh, okay. And I talked to the other guy. Oh, I didn't know this bloke. I just go along. So I got two different stories going on, and I couldn't break them. I'm out there, it's freezing cold. I'm getting them in my car to talk to them because the heat is on. It was really freezing cold. And after about 20 minutes or half an hour, I searched the car, didn't find anything that I could charge them with. And I'm thinking, and I did a check on warrants and all that sort of stuff, and nothing came up in the cars. And after a while, I'm freezing. I think, God, this is wrong, God. They're doing the wrong thing. Unless something happens in the next couple of minutes, I'm going home. I can't do anything about it, you know. And then I really felt to get one of them back in the car. So I get this guy back in the car. And then suddenly I found myself taking a totally different direction. I was asking him about his personal life. He tells me he's got a girlfriend. She's pregnant, first child, you know, da, 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 da. And I just come out, well, aren't you stupid doing this when you've got a baby coming? And he looked at me. His face started to quiver. And he broke down tears and told me everything. And I realised that night that God could make people tell the truth. And that was to serve me well, because then I would go out later on, and that was the first time. Then I'd find, guys growing marijuana in the bush in the middle of nowhere, and they're on the road, and I didn't know where it was, I didn't know which side to go, whatever. And they got smart after a while. They'd walk in a fire trail for maybe a kilometre, then they'd cut in the bush. So you'd have to go a long way to cut a track, and you know, you'd know how far you had to go. Anyway, I found that I could be praying, and these guys would then, end up confessing to me and taking me in the bush and showing me where it was. And the courts couldn't believe it. You know, and I get handwritten statements off them saying they've done all this sort of stuff in their own handwriting. And the defence hated those because the defence couldn't, we did verbal them. No, it's in their hand. It's in their own writing. They've signed it. Like the defence really hated these handwritten statements because they were just, you know, gold. And then I found that it wasn't just with stolen cars and marijuana and stuff. It was one night I had a really challenging case. I was on a two-man station at Robertson. My sergeant, we had a party line, one phone call coming in to two houses after hours. And whoever's on, we'd both pick up the phone if we're at home. If it was a police matter, whoever's on call would answer. If it's a personal matter, whoever's call would answer it and the other one hang up. Anyway, the phone went one night. I picked it up because I was on call. And the sergeant didn't answer, so there was no one home. And that was Warilla Radio telling me that, and I'm going to get to ministry stuff because this is all background of how a ministry happened for me in the church. Because I learned a lot about God as a policeman like this. I was really at the hard cutting edge of things going wrong in life where I couldn't walk away from, I had to deal with them. And I had to learn to trust God and rely on God in a way that really stood me well when I became minister. And this time I got a call from this people I knew at Warilla because of all the stuff was going on and charges. I knew them really well. And they said, look, an off-duty detective has spotted this guy at Albion Park driving up to Macquarie Pass. He told me who he was. This guy was the most wanted man in Australia. He'd been a hitman, escaped from jail in Melbourne. He was not going to be caught alive. He came from a great family of serious, really bad criminals in Melbourne. And it was a guy that said, if you approach his car, he'll just start shooting at you. He was really dangerous. We were all warned to be careful stopping cars and stuff when he was on the road. And he was known to be going between Sydney and Melbourne. And anyway, definitely identified, two in the car, he's known to be armed with automatic weapons, and they asked me to stop him. And all I got's a .38 revolver, and no sergeant at home, and he's coming my way. And so straight away I said, look, ring back, and she didn't ask any questions, she just rang back, and I'm praying, God, bring Harry home, I'm grabbing my gun, I'm grabbing my stuff, I'm running, I'm not worrying about police uniform, just whatever clothes I got and going. And I'm praying, God bring Harry. Harry walked home within 10 seconds, answered the phone. I said, get your gun, I'll see your car, it's urgent. So he knew it was serious, ran up the car, he beat me there, he jumps in the driver's seat, I'm driving out and telling him what's going on. I said, gee Harry, I'm glad you're driving because you know who they're going to shoot first, don't you? I'll tell you what he said anyway. And well, we dimmed the interior lights and all that stuff, we did everything. Anyway, we're going along and there was a fork. He could have gone the tourist road. Our thing was to get to the fork before he got there so we could work out which way he went. But we didn't, but we met him coming our way down the Illawarra Highway. There was nothing around. It was about 9 o'clock at night. There was no cars on the road. We're in a marked police car. We go past him, turn around and follow him. Does he know we're there? Yeah. And so we're expecting him, and with all the bends, we're expecting him to come around the bends and he'll open fire with this machine. He's supposed to have a machine pistol. He'll open fire with his machine pistol on us. So the strategy, we worked it out. I had my gun out. If we came around the bend and he was there, I'm just going to start shooting. And he pulls a gun, I'm shooting through the windscreen. Harry's taking avoidant action, I'm just opening up to give us a bit of time. That's all it was, because it would have been desperate. So we worked it all out. We called in for help, but help's going to take ages to get there. Finally, the help came. We blocked the road. We got this guy. End of story that... We got him out of the car, no one got shot. The passenger went for the gun, but thankfully in the last moment he put it down and got out. And where his hand had dropped down, that's where we later found the gun. When he did that, Harry and myself were only sort of here to the breakfast bar away from him. We were the only ones that had clear shot closest to him. In the country, we never got much weapons training. We might have got weapons training every 5 years or something. And sometimes we had a problem with, sometimes our bullets, we had to go and shoot some rabbits or something and get some new bullets because sometimes our bullets couldn't be relied on because we just weren't, you know, using them much. So it was quite acceptable to go and shoot something or shoot up a tree every now and then to change your ammunition and have a shot. For the first time in 5 or 6 years, we'd had weapons training. This was a Friday. We'd had weapons training on that Monday. So not only we had new ammunition, of all the people in the district, Harry and I were the two best shots. In that distance, we could easily shoot and kill. None of this stuff in the movies where you wing them, that's not on when you're in this sort of situation, particularly with a machine pistol. Machine pistol is like a machine gun, just point and spray. You know, so if he does that, you're in trouble. So we told the guy in the car, you come out with his gun, we shoot. We're not going to wait for you to line up on us. If we see a gun, we're shooting. And I knew that both Harry and I, our first shots would put him down, both of us. I had my finger on the trigger, I had pressure on the trigger. I knew exactly how much pressure to have. It was on double action, so it was. But I knew that I don't have to squeeze it. It was really that close. It was really serious. And I'm praying, and I'm praying. I've been praying all the time. You know. Anyway, we got this guy, and just in the movies, the cavalry came. They'd sent up from Warilla, they'd send 6 carloads of heavy armed guys with bulletproof vests and shotguns and rifles and all the gear, but they arrived once we had him on the ground arrested. And I'm praising God for this because I knew God could do this, but I also knew God could make people tell the truth. So I started praying that God would make this guy tell the truth. And so I'm praying during the night. I get a call the next morning from the guy in charge of the Warilla detectives, and a guy we knew very well from a whole lot of jobs. And he knew I was a Christian because of a whole lot of things that happened. And he said, Wayne, you won't believe it. Well, probably he will, but he said, 3:30 in the morning, this guy was telling us nothing. We couldn't get anything out of him. And then suddenly he wants to make a deal. And suddenly he tells us, he made the deal with us, and he tells us about murders and safe robbery. They actually had gelignite in the car, they're going to blow out a safe. Safe robberies, armed robberies, serious crime, Melbourne, Wollongong, Sydney, Newcastle, eastern seaboard of Australia. And he went into the witness protection program, never heard of again. No thing that he was ever arrested, just gone. And that was God. This guy that was a ruthless, hardened criminal, not only didn't he shoot us, but he actually changed. I had that happen with a drug dealer from Goulburn. This drug dealer was actually providing drugs in Cooma, Albury, Wagga, Queanbeyan, the southwestern part of New South Wales. He was the main supplier for drugs. People would go to him. He's a very smart guy in Goulburn. They would go to him. And he would then take them to Sydney, he would take their money, he'd go into a Rose Bay hotel, he would get the drugs, he would come out, give them the drugs, they would never see who he got it from. So he always remained the middleman. And I was involved one night, we arrested him with drugs and stuff. He was a brutal guy, he was known to kneecap people with a 22 and collect money with a baseball bat studded with nails. He was a brutal guy. And I was end up guarding him, and I'm a Christian, I think, what am I going to do? And I just tried to talk to him. I didn't have a chance. I gave him a Gideon pocket testament and I was really kept busy with doing stuff that night. I really didn't have much time to talk to him. And then he went off and was charged. I never saw him. And then about a month later, I hear he's out on bail. I couldn't understand why he was out on bail, but he's out on bail. And I hear that he's going around Goulburn and he's telling people about Christianity, and he's become a Christian. He's going to all these people who used to sell drugs and trying to convert to Christ. The detectives involved, they thought, oh, he's just trying to get out of his charges, you know. Anyway, he wasn't, and he's a Christian. I met him 2 years later, a barrel where we arrested him. It was on 1 o'clock in the morning, same time of night. I'm driving past the police car. I see him in a car parked outside the drug dealer's house. I think, oh no, he's relapsed. Swing around, pull him behind him. And I had my gun out thinking, oh, here he goes, because this guy was a pretty violent guy. And I had it down by my side as I approached the car thinking, okay, we could be on here. And turns out he was with his pastor from a church in Penrith. He was a pastor in a church. He was going to a conference in Melbourne. He wanted to show his pastor where his life had changed 2 years ago. And this guy was a brutal guy and he was transformed. So as a policeman, I was seeing God protecting me. I was seeing God powerful. I was seeing God able to convict people, to tell the truth, able to transform hardened criminals' lives. Then I became a minister. And when I was a minister in the church, I was sent to Camden and my hometown. Long story, but anyway, I was there and it really was a good thing. But I started finding, and I was really keen on evangelism, I found that being an ex-Gideon, seeing the power of the written word, I thought if you can get the people to read the word, respond to the word, God will transform their lives. And so I was keen to get the message of Jesus out there, get people to read the Bible for themselves. And I started seeing people responding and responding and responding. I was asked to be a police chaplain because I had been a policeman, and then I was asked to be an honorary chaplain when I was at Camden. As an honorary chaplain, I started to do lots of stuff over that time. I went to Bundanoon. While I was at Bundanoon, in 1997, the Thredbo landslide happened. When that happened, there was a chaplain, police chaplain at Queanbeyan and Goulburn, but I was his backup at Bundanoon. That's how it worked in those days. And when it happened, I rang up that morning. It happened at night. I rang up the next morning when I heard about it, and a senior chaplain happened to be going to at the Academy of Goulburn doing training. He said he was coming down. He asked me to come with him. I went down. And when we went down there, is that my phone? Sorry. No, it's mine. When we went down to Thredbo, I had seen God work and do things in ministry and in police work. I came to Thredbo and it was a mess. There were grieving families there. There was the whole slip was all muddy and slippery and moving, and water was flowing and really was limiting doing anything. And the families were really grieving. The media were there speculating, creating all sorts of issues then that weren't really true. And I suddenly found myself, the last thing I would have expected, and the last thing I would have put my hand up for, but I found myself talking to the families and seeing how much they were hurting. I talked to the person, there was a lady in charge of all the government aid and assistance that was there. All the government brought heaps of stuff down. She was in charge of it. She came from Barrel. I knew her from the community services there. I went up to her and said, look, how's it going? She said, no good. What do you mean? You got everything? No, we can't get any of the family to come to us to do stuff with us. They've just all got questions about what's going on. They all want information. They don't want to get any help. They want answers. I said, really? And I talked to a few families and they just really were very upset. And they weren't getting told anything because the police used to work in the way that you don't tell things until you actually know all the facts and you work it out later and you tell people because you want to be careful what you say, which was right. But the trouble with Thredbo, it wasn't going to be an hour or 2 hours, it was going to be days or weeks. So it wasn't something you'd not let information out. And so I said, we've got to do something differently. When I went to Thredbo and arrived, I went to the command centre at Jindabyne. I met Ken Moroney, who I happened to know Ken, and he knew me, and we said hello as an ex-policeman. He knew me. I said, oh, Ken, here you go. And we hit it off. I went up to the incident control centre at Thredbo. I went into the command there, and the guy charged Charlie Sanderson, who was actually at Coomera at that time. Charlie was a constable I worked with when I was at Liverpool. And we'd had a connection as friends at Liverpool. I hadn't seen him for a lot of years. Oh, you know. First thing Charlie said, he saw me, he said, is that you, Wayne? He said, Jesus Christ. I said, yeah, that's true. That's who I'm here for. And he said, anyway, he didn't say it in the right way, but anyway. But because I could suddenly see God's hand because Charlie was there. The guy who was in charge of the ambulance used to be the station officer at Camden when I was a policeman there. I knew him very well, Alan. Then two other guys, one I knew a bit and another. And I ended up connecting with four of the key leaders of the different areas really strongly. And suddenly I was the main sort of person doing the chaplain stuff with them. And I raised it with Charlie. I said, look, Charlie, the family need the information. Oh, we can't do them. I've got to work out. Yeah, but Charlie, if you got kids, I got kids. If our kids were in that lodge, wouldn't we want to find out? And straight away, he said, he stopped. He thought about it. He said, you're right. Yeah, we've got to do something. And all the other guys in the command, same thing. They said, yeah, we've got to do something. We can't not give some information out. This is just too important. So I worked out with Charlie that we next day at 10 a.m. he'd have a meeting with the families and he'd answer their questions and we'd start this process of opening up. And we weren't sure where it was going because it was totally new stuff that the police weren't doing. And we were just doing something totally different. But Charlie knew we had to do it. And So Nick, and I said to the families, look, 10 o'clock tomorrow, Charlie's going to come, answer your question, just wait on. They were threatening to go to the media, they were really upset. I said, don't do that, don't believe the media, wait till we have these debriefings with you. At 10 o'clock tomorrow we'll do it. And this was late in the afternoon. What happens about 9:45, or 9:30 next day, the Premier of New South Wales flies in with the police minister, with Peter Ryan, the police commissioner. They walk around the site, want to get a briefing and stuff. And it's coming on, it's 10 o'clock. I'm saying, Charlie, I'm following behind. Charlie, we've got to go. It's 10 o'clock. Come on, you know. And it's about 10 past 10. Charlie, we've got to go. You know, it's really going to blow up. Anyway, the secretary of the Premier got on and something's going on. Okay, what's going on? Explain what's going to happen. We're having a meeting with the family. She said, oh, the Premier would probably like to be there. Had to talk to the Premier. The Premier said, yeah. And I told him we're going to give this. We had to give him some information, debriefing because of the serious nature of it. Anyway, we had a meeting, the Premier came down, listened to all their stuff, listened to what we proposed about giving a debriefing, and he just rubber stamped. He said, yes, go and do it, make it happen. You know, do whatever you need to give them, whatever information you need to give them, give it to them. So we were able to actually do something that had never been done before with the Premier, the Police Minister, and now the Police Commissioner's full support to go and do it. And that's what we did. So there were closed briefings, only family members there, no media. We end up letting them, bringing in experts in every area, like the people doing the water stuff, people doing the whatever. They came in. If they had any requests, we gave them to them. We actually told them everything bar one thing. We're completely honest with them, except we held the truth back in one area. At one stage, they asked us, the people we were recovering, how badly damaged were they? And we didn't tell them they were mangled, because they would find out later on at the post-mortem and they'd find out later on. So it was no good telling them now. It wasn't something they were going to forever never know, but it was no good telling them at that point. And that was a deliberate thing that we held it back. But otherwise, we told them everything. And we even did in Des would know, the strange thing that we actually took them on site visits, showed them, because they were saying, why can't you do this? Why can't you? How come it's taking so long? In the end, we realised we need to take them down and show them the problems. Once we took them down and showed them, never had any questions afterwards about that. They accepted it was just really hard and we were doing our best and, you know, couldn't. See, other things like, why don't we bring a helicopter and just lift the slabs off? We'd looked at that, the downdraft from the helicopter was so much so that it would have moved the slabs downhill, made it worse. Everything they asked, either we'd already thought about, or one person actually said, you know, one of the people who was in the lodges had the ski instructor had a jacket with an avalanche, thing that would tell them where you are and locator, and come from Austria, and so we actually got our people, got onto Austria and got onto the manufacturer, got the code to activate the avalanche thing, to activate it to see if we could find them. We even did that, so we, you know, responded to whatever they said. We had hundreds of people to follow it up, and so I found something really, you know, I was. And that happened not because it was my great ideas, but it was just praying and listening and going forward with God. And I found we were staying, thankfully God provided us accommodation in the Alpine Hotel. One time I was there and I talked to the room service person about, get an extra towel or something or other. And she was really upset and struggling. I thought, and she was the person in the office and in charge of it. And I got talking to her, and I found the thing that we hadn't realised, this is about 3 days later, we hadn't realised that one of the lodges contained the middle management of the hotel. And all the middle management in the hotel died. And all the people had to step up, run things, their friend there died. And so a whole lot of people in the hotel were really grieving and having to do extra things and really struggling and stuff. And there was a massive thing there. And we spoke to Alan Ridge, who owned it all, and talked to him about it. And we organised. I passed that one. I had heaps of people. I said, look, can a psychologist go and sort that out? So they did debriefing and stuff. I found that as I pray and as I sought to serve the Lord, He made me aware of things or opened up things or even gave me solutions. Because when I came back from Threadbow, within 2 months or September, so 2-3 months, at Bundanoon, we suddenly had a run of suicides. This is where Bundanoon was living as a minister. And we had a run of suicides, and I mean a run. We had five happen in 2 and a bit weeks. It was to the point where we were having sort of two funerals, sometimes two funerals a day, or, you know, a couple of funerals a week, and people in the town ask who's going to be the next to die, and there's always speculation going. At number five, I started going around visiting people, being proactive, and I found something that worked. I found that I could go and talk to people about the grief they're experiencing of their friend who's died, and I could let them let their grief out and affirm it's right to be struggling with this. But I found that all of them had a whole lot of other things that they put aside, never dealt with, and the common thing was that they were now overcome with the things they hadn't dealt with in life and this new one that had come. It was like they had a closet in their mind where they put all the things that were too hard into their closet, and when they went in they were bad, they closed the door and they rotted away, and then they had opened up another one in, and the ones in there wanted to come out and they were even worse than when they put them in before. And they really needed some spring cleaning, so to speak. And spring cleaning meant they really need to start wrestling with them and talk about it and give them permission to be struggling with it and to somehow start letting it out. And I said to people, I was going to see, so a person died, when number five died, I thought, I asked around, who's their best friend? Who's the next risk for suicide? And they told me a guy. So I went and saw this guy, and his wife was there and kids, and he was really a mess. And his wife said, yeah, she's really worried about him. So I did this stuff listening to him and getting him to say, it's like a pressure valve release, that things build up in you and you need to let the pressure out. And talking is a good way of letting the pressure out and reducing it down and whatever. And I did some basic counselling with him. And then I said to the family, I said, look, is there someone that could just be the pressure valve release and let him talk to you and just listen? Don't sort of try and advise. Just listen. Be a sounding board. Could someone do that? And I get an agreement for someone to do that. I give them my card, look, 24 hours a day, any problem, give me a ring. Now, while this is on, I'll be there 24 hours a day. So I give him a card. Then I'd say to him, who else could I go and see? And he'd tell me someone else. Very quickly, I went around and stopped 13 more suicides. The second guy I went to was driving out of his driveway. I inadvertently went into his driveway and parked, not realising he was coming out. His wife was screaming at him from the front door. He had all the stuff to go and gas himself in the car. He was on the way to gas himself. The only thing that stopped him was I drove in the driveway at the wrong time, or the right time, whatever you want to say. And so I saw God, you know, creating opportunities and stuff. We had number six. It snuck through. One of the ones I talked to. It was one of the ones that I didn't talk to, that someone didn't spot, or people didn't spot. Number six happened, and then the town really went. We had the national media there making it worse. I was running the media gauntlet all the time. The town asked me to be the media spokesman. We had the media coming to homes of people who died in windows, trying to film things, trying to demand interviews of widows and stuff. It was horrible. So the town asked me to be the media person, and I ended up having to do all the interviews for the media, which was I hate that. Anyway, but I learned a lot about how to handle media. And then it was just out of control after number six, and the town just went flip. I'd been called into the pub because of what I'd done with these people. The publican heard about it, and the centre of all the depression and all the problems seemed to be the hotel and drinking going on there. People would come in with problems. There's so many people with problems at the hotel, they go out feeling worse. And with the alcohol helping, it didn't make any better. So the publican actually asked me to come in and do what I'm doing, going door to door. I said, well, how we do it? And we worked it out. The bar staff would actually, as they circulate around the bar, if they had any concerns about someone, they would come to me later on and tell me, I'm going to check shirt or whatever, and I'd go around and talk to him later on. But the only problem is, by the time I got to the pub, I'd done this stuff with all these guys for a couple of days, and when I got to the pub, every person wanted to buy me a beer. I had to nurse on a light beer and try and make it last the whole time, but I kept lining the beers up. It was embarrassing. I'd give them away to someone, you know. It was embarrassing. But it was really great. And so we, you know, stopped more at the pub, and it was really a good system working there. And I said to the publican, you know, you realise if I have my way, you're going to have not have many drinkers here. They're going to start going home and whatever. Number six happened, everything started to fall off again. We realised we had to have a meeting. And I always thought, you know, when it's really bad, you've got to take the bull by the horns. And how do you deal with this? And God gave me this vision of having a town meeting. It's the last thing I would have thought of, because the national media were there. It was a media circus anyway. A town meeting would make it even a mega media circus. I mean, it was everywhere. And we even had overseas media there. Because now, by now, it was a phenomenal worldwide. It doesn't happen like this. We had this town meeting, we had media issues and problems keeping the media out, but we sort of did that. One snuck in there. The way God provided it was that I had a friend who was a school teacher down there. Turned out he'd been overseas doing studies in suicide, came back and did training with the New South Wales Education Department schools in suicide prevention. He was their expert. I had another friend from Narelle and from Lifeline, Margaret Appleby. She was the Lifeline suicide person for Australia. And they were two friends that were helping me anyway. And so we had a town meeting and they spoke, those two spoke, and then I finished up and I actually bought a bit of the gospel in the end and tied it up a bit. And I prayed at the end. And then I'd worked it out that when we were all together, I'd get my church some of the other churches to serve supper, and there are four exits in the town hall. I said, let's have supper at all four exits. Instead of just having it there, let's try and take it out to people to give them cups of tea and give them some cooked food. So I had a lot of older people doing this. When the meeting finished, straight away they had the stuff there and they started bringing it out and circulating around and giving people, or people tried to get out the door, they'd give them a cup of tea and stuff and get them. And it all changed after that. 3 months later, I had three professors knock up at my doorstep. One from Perth, one from Sydney, I forget, the last one might have been Melbourne. But anyway, they came because this was a worldwide phenomenon. They'd been asked by some international group to come and do a paper on this. For the worldwide psychological services or whatever it was. Anyway, I told him, I said, look, at the end of it, can you come back and tell me, you know, what you find? Anyway, might have been a month later, and they were pretty busy talking to people. A month later, came back and met me and said, look, Wayne, we found the watershed, the time of change was the public meeting. I said, yeah, I know that, because there are no suicides after that. And we found the actual part of the public meeting where it all changed. And I said, okay, that'd be interesting. What is it? It was supper. It was unqualified people showing God's love, serving cups of tea and coffee and slice. Because what it meant was these people who were all fractured by fear and anxiety and worry and grief and all negative stuff, and withdrawn into themselves and sort of becoming paranoid and stuff, suddenly started to connect with each other again the way they used to. And they acted on what we'd actually taught that night, started acting on that straight away. Rather than going home forgetting about it, it was still in their minds. They started acting on what we'd said to them that night as they had cups of tea together and started talking. And these experts, and they were Australian, if not worldwide experts on this, identified the Christian serving, lovingly serving tea and coffee as what changed everything. Isn't that an amazing story? Sorry, behind that there's a heap of prayer going on. You know? There's God, there's me praying, the church is praying, everyone's praying, and then God used that action to change everything. So what I've learned from that is, and at that point, I knew from when I was at Threadbow that God could do things that all the experts couldn't do and give us new things to do that the experts wouldn't think of. Not only go at experts, please don't get me wrong. I found it in Bundanoon, I found the Southwestern Sydney Health Service are good, but they were used to people coming to them. So they came to Bundanoon, set up, they had an office out there ready, they opened their office up, their letterbox dropped, they said, you know, come to us, we'll offer all these services. People didn't come. I went out to people and engaged people, and that worked. In the end, the Southwestern Sydney Health Service said to me, look, here's all our staff. Here we've got $250,000 in the bank. You can have all that. You go and deal with it how you want it. You be the point person. I didn't need the money. And I used their staff a bit. I actually took one of their guys with me and showed him how to go and do the stuff proactively, and he really benefited from that. But it was just a different way of doing it. And it was a Christian way. And we're called to be Christians to live in the world. Not to sit back and watch, but actually to live in, to go out and be salt and light, aren't we? And to go out and love our neighbour as ourselves. We're called to go out into the world. And that's all I was doing. And God used it. And I found that God can also help me, help us. What Paul says, you know, my grace is sufficient for you. I found myself back against the wall in a really hard, difficult place as a policeman, as a minister, and not knowing what to do, and somehow sometimes wanting to run away from it all because I just don't know what to do. But then I can pray and God can give me the strength and God can provide the direction. God can turn it all around no matter what it is. And that's something that applies to each and every one of us, not just to me. Because we all face things in life that are sometimes way too hard and we can't cope. And sometimes we face things in life where we can't see a way forward. It just looks all black and horrible. But God can help us. God can either provide the way out of it, the escape, or he can give us the strength to just keep going and going and going and get through it. I found that over and over. I could be here all day telling you stories. God opened up something, and God can lead us in ways that we don't expect. When I was at Bible college in 1987, there was a coup in Fiji. And somehow or other, I really reacted to that and got a great burden to pray for Fiji. And I thought it was because of the coup and being a policeman and stuff. Anyway, I found that when the next coup happened in 2000, I was still praying for Fiji every time I saw an ad, which is about every Sunday's newspaper. It's an ad for Fiji holidays. So I'm praying for Fiji, and now 14 years has gone past, and I'm thinking, what's God doing? Why has he laid this burden to Fiji on my heart? It was never to go and have a holiday there. I could have jumped on a plane and a holiday. Never have that. I couldn't understand it. I came to Richmond 2001, in July 2001. I thought in 2000, I really would like to find an answer to this. I come to Richmond July 2001. I really felt God wanted me to go there. A lot of other places I was offered, I really felt God didn't want me to go there. But Richmond, for some reason, I did. I get to Richmond, I get a postcard from Fiji. I don't know anyone in Fiji. They got missionaries in Fiji. Turned out I'd done some ministry for their family. Anyway, they came back, the missionaries came back, told me about their work in Fiji. My heart just warmed to the people. I thought, really, I'd like to go and engage with the people, see what happens. They invited me over there. Cut a long story short, I quickly met up with a leader and got sent to a place which turned out to be a backwater, but turned out to be really strategic in years to come, and has always been strategic. I would have never picked it. I'm now doing stuff with the leadership of a number of different denominations in Fiji. I take a gap year program, year 13, from a youth works college. I take them over to Fiji for their mission. They came to me about asking me to take them there. And I take them there every year doing some tremendous stuff. We have this gap year program where youth who finish high school before they go to university, before they go into workforce or whatever they're going to do, go for 10 months from February to November to a Bible college. They do some Bible study. They can work towards a diploma if they want to, but some don't, but many do. We teach them about life skills of how to budget, how to driving skills, about how to get around. But particularly want to teach them about how to make good decisions in life in regards to what the Bible says. How to not have their parents' faith, but have their own faith. To understand what it means for them to be independent and to make decisions, even if there's no one to advise them. So we're working towards that. In the middle of the course, we take them for a month to Fiji. We do ministry over there, but in Fiji, it's a great environment because it's a very sympathetic to Christianity over there country. But we immerse them. We're not tourists. We are tourists, but we don't go as normal tourists because we actually go and stay where the locals stay, or we stay with the locals and we eat the local food, not our food. And we go into the schools and we go home with the students and stay with the students. We travel on the local transport. We do, but we don't. When we had 25 going, we'd take the local transport. Now we've got 120 going, we can't fit on the bus. We have to have our own buses sometimes. But other times we use the local transport. Well, we can't flood the transport and stop locals from travelling. But we just keep going to come back to do more and more and more in Fiji. And the interesting thing about the youth that go, we do a lot of stuff beforehand with them to prepare them. We do a lot of debriefing as they go. They're in groups. They also have a buddy that they talk to and discuss things with. They keep a journal which they write up what they're experiencing and how they're processing it. We also do reorientation training at the end to help them go back into Australia. And we found after a month living at the local level, they've started to take on life in the local level to the point where they get really shocked coming back to Australia with the choices we have with the lifestyle. We even say to them, when you go swimming over there, we want all the guys and girls to wear t-shirt to cover themselves up and to wear boardies to cover themselves up. When we come back, we go to a really low, poor backpacker resort thing, and sometimes we see girls in bikinis and guys and stuff, and our guys going, they're so in tune to sort of covering up, they get shocked when they come back and see what's normal in our beaches. The thing that stands out for me with this is, I see the change in them when I'm over there. I often meet parents years later, and parents will come up to me and say, oh, thanks for taking my son or daughter to Fiji. I said, when was it? Often I don't remember who their son or daughter is because there's so many of them. I said, how's it been for them? They said, look, they came back, they were quiet for about a week and we were worried that something had gone wrong. And then they came out of themselves and started talking about things and we suddenly realised they changed. I said, was it a good change or a bad change? He said, oh, we got a son or daughter back that was just so great, so brilliant. We never thought they could change the way they did. I've only heard one person say the opposite. Only one. And I've also, and this one that had the opposite, had mental health issues, didn't declare it to us, got over there, got themselves in a real hole, didn't tell us. It wasn't until they completely crashed we realised they had a problem and it was too late then to help fix them up. But all the others we were able to do. But the thing is, when I talk to these people years later, I say, look, what's your son or daughter doing? And what I always seem to find out, going to year 13 has started them on a growth, and particularly Fiji has really rocketed that growth, but they've just continued to grow over the years. And they're involved in ministry, they're involved in service in churches. The amount of, we've had 700 go through now, and the amount that are in full-time ministry is starting to get big. And it's all because of this transformation time in year 13. So I go there and I think, oh, the graduation was this month, and our church has always had people doing it, and we've actually had more. We've only had two or three doing it every year. But we've had more than any other church anywhere doing it, and we've seen the changes in big time. And I was there just recently thinking, God, what a blessing that you allowed me to be involved with this. What a blessing to see the transformation in these lives. I really count it as a blessing. Enough. Any questions? I'm sure there's some. Anyone want to ask a question about that sort of stuff? Yep.
A couple of questions.
Yep.
My daughter was in year 13, year before.
Yep.
She stayed with Peter and Vinny.
Peter and Vinny, they're a lovely couple, yeah. Oh, they're good, they're good. Yeah, they're going up the coast. Yeah, they're going to keep doing it though.
Yeah, I was there.
Yep.
With Emma and my best daughter and all about Georgie.
Yep.
They loved it. And how long has it been going now? That
10 years we've been going to Fiji. It was going 2 years before. They were going to Kenya. And they went to Kenya 1 year, and the cost involved was really high, and there was some instability in Kenya, and some of the experiences weren't what they hoped. And after the first year, they came and saw me, because Trinette, who's the actual deputy director of Year 13, who runs the Fiji mission, she'd been my youth worker, and I took her to Fiji in 2003. So when they're doing Kenya, and they realise Kenya's not working, and they're looking for someone else, she said, I'll go to Fiji. Wayne can organise that. So that's how I got involved. And once we moved, before when they go into Kenya, they had lots of parents ringing up very anxious about how it's going to go and what's going to happen. And lots of kids didn't go because there's lots of anxiety about it. As soon as they went to Fiji, no parents rang up and a whole sack more kids came. And we reduced the cost by half. And it's just it's a 4-hour trip, so it's easier. Where Kenya was 16 hours or more, 20 hours to get to with a stopover on the way.
Another question.
Yep.
Quick one. Yeah, how about the laws and the police force and the PTSD? How do you keep an even level keel?
Yeah, I've got a PTSD group at Richmond. It's a horrible thing. PTSD is where you just... what happens with people with PTSD, they have this closet of horrible things that have happened in their mind, and they keep opening up. And how it happens is they often have nightmares. They have these things come back, or something triggers it on the news or whatever, triggers some memory, and it just keeps coming back. I found with PTSD, and this applies to anyone with anything that happens, when it happens, if you can deal with it in a right way when it happens, you'll go a long way to how it affects you. And I learned that as a policeman. When you come to an incident, the initial response as soon as you arrive can dictate how the whole thing goes. If you come in with sirens blazing and yelling and screaming or whatever to get things sorted out, like if it's a brawl or whatever, but if you come in quietly and can calm it down straight away and set on the right course, that's how it'll go. Same with PTSD stuff. If it happens to you, something horrible, it's good to be able to straight away try and process it, try and talk to someone about it. What I find with PTSD particularly, people will continue to go on because they've got coping mechanisms. They've got coping mechanisms of their friends, of fitness stuff, of alcohol sometimes. But then they'll have an injury that will actually sideline them, a back injury or something like that. As soon as they have an injury and can't be working, can't do the physical stuff, can't do the alcohol, suddenly the PTSD comes out and starts taking over. The injury will get fixed up and they'll go back to work, but the PTSD won't go away then. It's got them. And the way to get rid of it is, the way to minimise it, you can't get rid of it. I still get PTSD sometimes because things will trigger memories to me and I'm just going to say, no, hang on. The way to deal with it is to recognise it's right and human to grieve and be upset by some things. It's normal. It's right to be upset and grieve by it. And it's right sometimes not to be able to cope with things because we can't always cope. I particularly turn to Jesus and about, when I'm weak, I'm strong, what I read to you before, I read in Philippians where it says, rejoice in the Lord always and don't be anxious about anything, but pray always in chapter 4, verse 6. Prayer is a great thing for me to cope with PTSD. If it's someone who's not a Christian, I would just listen to them and reaffirm that they're right to be upset about that, but I'd be encouraging them to try and put it in the past. You can't ever forget about it. It'll always be there, but not let that control the present. I'd be encouraging them to look at physical exercise, look at doing things with friends. PTSD tends to want to isolate you, and when it does, it's got you. It really has. So you've got to try and get them out of being isolated. Does that make help?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you can't help it. I got these guys in my PTSD group. One guy joined there. I've been doing it for 12, 14 years, I suppose. I had one guy every month we meet, and I'd be just happy to keep him alive that month. He was so damaged. And all of the marriage breaks up because they have these horrible nightmares. You can't sleep in the same bed with them because the wives find that they wake up, they thrash around at night, they suddenly think they're in a fight as a policeman, and if you're in bed with them, the wives get up in the morning black and blue, and one case, the bloke was choking the wife thinking he's fighting this criminal, that he was reliving something that happened, and so it really is a horrible thing, and it's broken marriage. This guy ended up having his marriage broke up, he ended up getting a girlfriend who understood, and that she would sleep in a different bed. But also he needed space, so they've moved away and she's got a house nearby. Some days they'll be together, some days they won't, because sometimes you need space, and she's realised that. And that's been really helpful, good for him, and he's slowly getting better. But it's a long, long, once this PTSD gets a hold of you, it's a long, long process. And you never fully get over it. As I said, sometimes I get things that I relive some of the horrible things that happen, and I say, nah, hang on, I pray about that and get rid of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
But it can happen to anyone with anything. You know, it could be the death of a close family friend or, you know, member or something, or some horrible things happen to you. You know, even bushfires and disasters can happen, and you can get affected by that too. Any other questions? Yep. No, it wasn't real, but it was dead. It was real, but it was dead. But the guys had actually, they killed early in the day, but they actually put it in the oven or on the heat or something, so it felt sort of, it didn't feel cold, it felt a bit warmish, and anyway, I just felt it, and I was, my heart was pumping so much, that scared the living daylights. Yeah. Yep, yep. Yeah, yeah, I could believe that, yeah. No, that, yeah. Yeah, yeah. And I at one stage, I thought these guys don't like me. You know, I thought they, and then the farewell thing showed they did, and I really got sort of, and the later on when I came back and they told me the story, they were testing me out and they were impressed. Then it finally made sense, but that was about 15 years, no, about 10 years later. But for a while I just couldn't reconcile what they were doing to me and the end result together. And so, I mean, look, it doesn't matter who you are as a Christian, you can be anywhere. You can have people, if you want to open and live as a Christian, you put your head out and people will try and they'll give you, you paint a target on yourself for some people. And they will want to do things and, yeah. It's annoying, but anyway. Yep. 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 It does.
I didn't really get to know the people that talked, but there was a shop with mansion and a lot of mansion went.
Yeah.
And I have formed a friendship with Stuart Diver.
Yep.
And recently I found that he's lost his second wife. I used to work with. She was in the restaurant. It's a small community for everybody.
It does, and it stays with you, you're right. And it's good to stay with you in one sense, because you're a caring human being. You're not hardened, you know, to life and rock hard and don't care. You care. And when you care, you're then vulnerable. And that's the tough part. And somehow it's a balance between, and once you get hurt, the easier way to do it is just sort of toughen yourself up and become really hard to life and hard to everything. But the trouble is you don't just harden yourself to that problem, you harden yourself to everything. And you damage all your relationships, that's the trouble. So it's really hard to be vulnerable and to deal with it, and you're right. My apologies, because part of my, I was actually on night shift with a senior chaplain. When we went up there, I did the night time because I was used to it as a policeman. He did the day stuff. When I identified stuff, I handed over to him. But then later on, I thought, I wonder if they've got everyone that needed to be talked to, because I think they just went to they went to Alan Ridge, and then they went to the people he identified. But I think there was people like you lower down who they needed to do stuff with, because you guys were busting your guts. I saw that with the housekeeping and with the kitchen staff, busting their guts to serve meals, to cater for everyone, because the place was packed. And everyone was giving more and more they could possibly do, but at the same time bearing all this grief of what's going on. And I think that, going back, we do it differently now. But it was one of those ones we were having to... It was unprecedented, so we had to make it up as we go. I was just grateful to God that I met that housekeeping person and realised what had happened, because we didn't tweak to that at all. Yes.
Yep. During the bushfires that came through,
Because what I learned from Fred, by putting the place when I got to Bunurin, and that idea of a town meeting, I actually did the town meeting. I now realise that's the way to go with the community. At Glossodia, where I live, there was a horrible murder. I won't go into it. It was really horrible, witnessed by school children. A family killed their mother. It was a disgusting thing. And I realised that we need to have a town meeting to deal with it. Because people, even people who didn't see it, heard about it, were all affected, because it was a community. And we had a town meeting and we dealt with it there, and it really helped people to go forward with it. And we did it quickly, not days later, but the next day we had the town meeting. We should have done that with the residents of Threadbow, but I didn't know about it at that time. But if we're going back now, I would have said to the powers to be, let's get all the residents together, let's tell them what's going on, let's help them put in perspective, because not only did they know them and relate it, but they're also impacted by what's ongoing in the stuff. And we didn't do that because we didn't know about it, but now we do. So apologies for that. Yeah, you live and learn, but it's like you find, you don't forget, do you? It stays with you.
Plus, I've got a nurse in the federal police.
Yep.
And I didn't realise, because I heard the radio, yep. I heard the noise, and then it was like, I had the phone turned off, and in that, I shouldn't have time, because she heard.
And I know when I got.
As soon as I phone off, I didn't go to the end to have a look until a couple of days later. And then I was shocked to see that the mess that took place. It was strange at night that I heard this bang.
And I know when I got there the next day, a lot of people were saying about how they'd heard people crying out and stuff, and they couldn't go onto the thing because it was so slippery. It was really a horribly frustrating time. But I've got to finish up, but can I say that the God has helped me in so many ways. I find most of all how I see God work in telling people about Jesus Christ and seeing them respond. And I can, be praying for people, and I know that the God who can do things in whatever situation can actually change someone's heart and get them to listen and get them to respond. And I see that most of all. That's the exciting thing. Thank you very much.